We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. We are continuing our end of year overhyped, underreported
continuing coverage of the end of the year.
Of the end of the year. It's going to go for another, 11 months. We'll have a new one. All right. So,
Do I get new theme music for 2014?
No, that wasn't in the budget.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Damn. Oh, well. But we'll be getting to, we'll be doing that with the international overhyped,
yes,
underreported.
That is correct.
Okay. In the meantime, we have a couple of other stories. One local story this week, the Boeing machinist's contract. After turning down the contract a few weeks ago, the Boeing...
For the perplexing reason that it was terrible.
Yes. The head of the national union told workers that they would have to go back and vote on a slightly revised contract offer for an extension of their current contract to win the Boeing 777X work. This is in spite of local union officials' determination not to vote on this contract because it varies very little from the one that was turned down by workers just a few weeks ago.
And can I say something else about the about the terminology of that? It's not really an extension. That's what Boeing is calling it, is an extension of the current contract, but it's really a brand new contract.
It's a new contract, yeah.
Because their current one goes to 2016.
Yeah, but yeah. What they're basically doing is tearing that up and replacing it with a much worse one.
Yeah, and the head of the national, Buffenbarger, he is sending out a letter to Boeing workers to explain what the terms of the new Boeing contract are and to urge them to vote on it, which really is lobbying on behalf of the company. And I really don't understand how that's part of his role as head of the national union. Also, you look at that and you just say, okay, how is it that the head of the national union can be so divorced from what's going on at the local level and really working on behalf of the company rather than on behalf of the workers? And this is not unusual, really, with these large unions.
Yeah, it really – by the way, the person that Mike interviewed at 7:30 is the person running against this gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
So not the person that you just heard, but – it really does underscore what I think has been a lot of the – I mean, obviously, there's been a huge amount of anti-labor legislation and activity by large corporations for the last, several decades. But part of the downfall also has been this whole business agent model of unionization within the labor movement over the last half century or so, in which you have these unions, the upper management of the unions really, working hand in hand with the management of the corporations and, becoming advocates for the companies that they're supposedly advocating for the workers for. It really and sometimes the interests of the companies and the interests of the unions are not congruent. And that's very definitely what we're seeing here.
Yeah, and so you're hearing Buffenbarger say things like, well, there's no more time to negotiate. This is the last chance you'll get to vote on a new contract. Blah 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 blah. Instead of really, representing the workers that he was selected to represent.
Wasn't J.P. Buffenbarger like a Muppets character or something? It does sound like a children's show kind of thing.
The key one, another key word there is selected, yeah, as opposed to elected.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Moving on to a national, President Obama signing the Defense Authorization Act.
Yeah, the 2014 National Defense Authorization Act. It's been a couple of years now that the NDAA has been particularly controversial, going back to, and of course, the NDAA every year has, obscene budgets for the Pentagon and for covert ops and so forth. But in 2012, it attracted a great deal of additional attention because for the first time it codified as official U.S. government policy the policy of allowing the government to indefinitely detain without charges and without trial even U.S. citizens, even on U.S. soil. And that particular provision continues in the 2014 NDAA, even with a lot of criticism and even with Obama being on record as saying that he wants to move away from that and in particular close Gitmo, then neither of those things is happening in the 2014 NDAA. You still have, of course, huge budgets for the drone program and covert ops and limitless spying and so forth. But there are a couple other areas where there were issues this year, too, along with the indefinite detention. One is an issue that, no thanks to the Pentagon, has gotten a lot of attention this year, which is the issue of sexual assault in the military. There were a number of reforms that were included this year for the NDAA, particularly around prosecutions. Anyone who engages in sexual assault and is found to have done so will now face dishonorable discharge, which wasn't happening in the past. That's a good thing. Commanders are prevented from reversing jury decisions, also a good thing. There will be some legal assistance now for victims. And retaliation against a victim is now, as an official policy, punishable. But the problem with this, of course, investigation by the commanding officers, including the commanding officers of the alleged perpetrators, or even if the commanding officer is the alleged perpetrator, that will continue. And retaliation can only be punished if the victim is willing to report the retaliation, meaning the victim trusts the system enough when the system is already retaliating against her or him. So there's still some deeply problematic aspects to how the military handles sexual assault allegations, and that has not been fixed by the new provisions. According to the Department of Defense itself, roughly 86% of sexual assaults in the military go unreported. And for the primary reason for that is victims fearing punishment up to and including job termination for speaking out. So this will be it's minor improvement, but it's not going to fix that that major problem, and it's certainly not going to fix the culture of violence and the culture of misogyny that leads to the sexual assaults in the first place. And now there's a brand new problem that has been created by this year's NDAA. It establishes something called the Conflict Records Research Center, which compiles this is a direct quote using the very same gobbledygook that the Pentagon uses, the digital research database, including translations and to facilitate research and analysis of records captured from countries, organizations, and individuals now or once hostile to the United States. You know, the English version of that is that it's yet another surveillance database, including records on anybody, including U.S. citizens, thought that to now or once in the past maybe have been hostile to the United States.
And of course, just critical of the United States.
Well, yeah, that's the problem, is there is no definition of hostile to the United States. And hostile to the United States could be hostile to a particular policy of the government, for example, mm-hmm. like, say, somebody who doesn't like the particular war that they're fighting this week, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not defined and it's not restricted in any way in terms of how that is set up. So yet another thing to keep one's eye on the NDAA this year as it keeps getting, worse.
Well, speaking of worse, update this week on the NSA.
Yeah, I remember last week we mentioned that a federal judge had ruled that the NSA's spying program on everybody was unconstitutional as a grotesque violation of the Fourth Amendment, preventing unreasonable search and seizure. Well, yesterday, another federal judge weighed in on this spying program as a result of a lawsuit by the ACLU. This time, U.S. District Judge William Pauley in Manhattan ruled that the NSA spying is lawful. He called it a counterpunch to terrorism that does not violate Americans' privacy rights, that despite zero evidence that it actually prevents terrorism, and it's being a program that pretty much by definition violates everybody's privacy rights. The upshot of this, along with various other rulings that have happened over the course of the year, is that it's going to go up to the United States Supreme Court with their ever vigilant about civil rights record. I'm sure they'll be wanting to rule on this pronto.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. On to a CNN poll on Congress.
Yeah, this week CNN ORC International did a poll of Americans asking them what they thought of Congress. And no surprise here, two-thirds of Americans say that the current Congress is the worst they can remember. And three-quarters slammed it as a do-nothing legislative body. That's no surprise at all. And that's in the face of Republicans who seem to think that a government that does nothing is the best government ever. Clearly, Americans don't agree with that.
Yeah. Well, and the poll also found that by a 15% margin, more Americans would prefer to have a venereal disease than contemplate Congress. So
no, that's not it.
Do they ever have polls on what the Americans think of the Supreme Court?
I don't know.
I don't remember us ever doing one on that. So
no, that would be a good one too.
That would be a good question to ask.
Yeah. Well,
not that they have any accountability, but
no.
Yeah. Well, the automated robot has you on the phone if you could punch a number for that.
Or that members of the Supreme Court are ever elected. I think these polls are mostly done on Congress to sort of warn our legislators. Look, you guys, if there were election tomorrow,
yeah, you got to get your marketing campaign up and running.
You'd be in trouble.
although if you look at these polls and the way they break down, it almost invariably is, well, I like my member of Congress. I just don't like Congress as a whole. And so they keep getting reelected. It's pretty counterintuitive.
I think they tend to time it more when the Congress is going home for a break and how safe it is for them to return to the All right. Let's move on then to international and overhyped and underreported stories for the year.
Yeah. Let's start with the overhyped. And by far the overhyped international story of the year is, oh, my God, we've got to bomb Syria. We've got to bomb Syria. And we went through not one, but people may have forgotten at this point, two iterations of this. The first happened in February when there were alleged chemical weapons use by the Syrian government. In the town of Khan al-Assal, killing 31 people. Those allegations disappeared after a few days, quite mysteriously, and were never revisited, probably because there was no substance to them. And then, of course, we had the second round in August, where chemical weapons clearly were used, and it really hasn't ever clearly been defined by whom. Although the United States government is quite convinced that it was by the Syrian government. And in that case, we had over a month of, oh, my God, we've got to bomb Syria. There's no choice. We have, you know, and the rationale for it being that, well, they've crossed a red line, which seems like the worst rationale ever for killing a whole lot of people is that, well, a mythical line has been crossed by which and by doing which you've challenged our dignity. Like, what the hell is this? Is this like high school or a gang mentality or exactly what is it? But and then, of course, no thanks to the United States, Russia took an offhand comment by Secretary of State John Kerry and called him on his bluff and said, well, we can get the UN to do something about the chemical weapons store, and glory be, war was averted. But that was by far the most overhyped. Another interesting one was, of course, the perennial, the nuclear weapons threat of Iran and the nuclear program of Iran, which is routinely referred to as such, as we hear pretty much every week on Counterspin, one another outlet talking about, you know, Iran's nuclear weapons program, when in fact there's been no evidence for over a decade now. And the United States intelligence community has not thought for over a decade now that Iran has an active nuclear weapons program. There's no evidence of it. None. But you would not know that from listening to American media.
What they have is a nuclear enrichment program, but enriched nuclear material can be used for a lot of different things, including power generation.
Yes, which is what Iran claims.
Yeah.
And what the actual U.S. sold them years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And, of course, you know, the North Korean nuclear threat is vastly overstated, too, because, you know, North Korea has, like, what, maybe 1, 2, 3 nuclear weapons, which, you know, if they attach them to carrier pigeons, they could probably get a longer range than they can get with their missiles. So, you know, it's the sort of thing where, no, the West Coast is not under attack from intercontinental ballistic missiles launched by North Korea. That is decades away from happening. And let's not talk about the thousands upon thousands of nuclear missiles and weapons owned by the only country who's ever actually used a nuclear weapon in wartime, the United States. And let's not talk about the hundreds of nuclear weapons owned by the United States' closest ally, Israel, which are, you know, not legal and not sanctioned under international law, but we never talk about those.
Or the thousands of warheads based 20 miles from where we're broadcasting from.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Actually, I think it's a little less than 20 miles, but yes. Over in Bangor Nuclear Subbase, the largest repository of nuclear weapons in the United States.
As they build a second explosive handling wharf there to handle even more.
And oh yes, not only 20 miles, but 20 miles that from the prevailing winds are generally upwind. Just saying.
All right. So that's on the overhyped. Anything else on that, or are we moving on?
Well, just briefly, it was very interesting this year to contrast the handling in U.S. media of the obituaries of Margaret Thatcher and Nelson Mandela. You know, in much of the world, the coverage of Thatcher was very different than that of Mandela, because Thatcher was treated as a very controversial figure that was still loved and still hated by a lot of people. But it was almost all uncritical in the United States. Whereas with Mandela, it was pretty much universal acclaim worldwide. But in the United States, certainly in right-wing media, you still had tremendous criticism of Mandela. It was a very interesting sort of flip there, because I think, you know, years from now, in terms of who's considered a person who inspired folks around the world, there's really only one of those two, and it's not going to be Mrs. Thatcher.
All right.
So the underreported, at the top of my list, Jav already mentioned Iran's so-called nuclear weapons program. At the top of my list is the agreement with Iran to freeze its nuclear enrichment program for 6 months, proving that, yes, in spite of what the Republicans believe, diplomacy can work. Number two on my list is U.S. weapons sales abroad. This past year, it totaled $66.3 billion and made up three quarters of the total market. That's a record high. Now, the U.S. sets record highs every year in weapons sales, but this year was a stunner. And much of it, of course, was sold to Middle Eastern nations, not to Iran, of course.
Yeah. At the top of my list, and we mentioned this already with the National last week, but pretty much everything to do with climate change, in this case, climate change science, which has really been cut back in terms of coverage of just about all media in the United States, the actual science surrounding climate change, because quite frankly, it's depressing and people don't like to hear depressing news. But the science is telling us that every time we imagine a worst case scenario, what is actually taking place is turning out to be worse. So that, for example, you know, we had a report in February that Arctic permafrost is moving at a far more rapid rate than previously known. And a July report that ground ice and permafrost in the Antarctic is now melting just as rapidly as in the Arctic. And of course, those are particularly important, not just for the fresh water that is going to help raise sea levels, but also because of the permafrost, that the methane released is much, much more efficient at trapping greenhouse gases. And that could really
accelerate
global warming,
climate change,
and
yeah.
climate change a great deal in ways that we don't fully understand yet. Very, very frightening stuff. But that is being underreported. And then, of course, as we mentioned last week, the complete inability of the United States and unwillingness of certain segments of the United States to do anything about this is also underreported and very troubling. The other thing that was underreported, interestingly, this year, even though most aspects of the conflict aren't, is that a lot of what Israel was doing was underreported this year, particularly the continuing expansion of what are euphemistically called settlements. And settlements, by the way, is a term, and settlers is a term that I hate, because it implies that, they're pioneers exploring, you know, uninhabited land, when no, what they are doing is stealing inhabited land. These aren't settlements. This is like somebody coming in, knocking down your house, and then setting up camp on that property. That's not a settlement. It's
appropriation.
It's theft.
Yeah.
But the fact that those are continuing to expand in areas like East Jerusalem and the West Bank that are pretty explicitly prohibited by international law and by, for example, the Oslo Accords, which Israel's been pretty much ignoring since they were signed, 20 years ago now. Very, very disturbing that that's getting almost no coverage in the United States, especially in mainstream media.
Yeah. Also on my list was the Rana Plaza factory collapse in April, where over 1,000 people died in Bangladesh. This was the worst industrial accident in the history of the garment industry. You could call it not necessarily an accident, but a willful killing of workers by the factory owners themselves for not keeping up the safety of their building and for expanding the building beyond anything that was structurally sound. This led to a coalition of European companies pledging to improve working conditions, but U.S. companies weaseled out of the agreement and set up their own much less stringent inspection program.
Voluntary, which is
Bangladesh and European
works so well for corporations in the United States.
Yeah, and European countries put together a fund to pay for building improvements in Bangladesh, whereas U.S. companies are fearful they may have to spend even a penny.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to.
Also
do that.
On my list was the European Union banned neonicotinoids. Those are the pesticides implicated in colony collapse disorder and the death of honeybees, and also are turning out to apparently have a disturbing impact on young children's neurological development, according to studies done in the European Union. But of course, they're still legal in the United States, and they are very popular here. One of the most popular types of pesticides you can buy at the local garden store.
Roundup, for example.
Yeah.
And of all the seeds that are in turn manufactured to be compatible with the neonicotinoids. And let's face it. I mean, if bees didn't smoke, then they would. Never mind. Also on my list, we actually do still have a war that U.S. troops are fighting in Afghanistan, and it's not even so much a NATO war or a coalition war anymore because most other countries have pulled out. Afghanistan, but the United States is still there, and we keep killing civilians. Most of the news that we're getting on network TV and the big newspapers is about something or another that Karzai does that the United States government doesn't like. But a lot of what has been drawing the fire of Karzai is when he complains about these civilian massacres, which the United States routinely denies, and then a few weeks later quietly admits, well, yeah, I guess that did happen, and I guess that was us, and we're really sorry, but it was an accident, and it won't happen again.
And it really wasn't as bad as Karzai claimed.
Yeah. So we still have that. The other thing that has sort of gone down the memory hole pretty quickly was an April report that the CIA for years has been making cash payments to Afghanistan government officials, and that those cash payments are massive in terms of the amount of money that's being transferred, not being tracked at all, and that a lot of it's winding up in the illegal drug trade, which is much of Afghan's economy, and is helping support not only the Taliban, but all which we hear some in the media, but is also helping support an awful lot of local and national Afghan government officials.
And the Afghan government at the same time claims that they can't pay their bills, so that they're not paying lower level of functionaries, including members of the Afghan police force.
Yeah, the theme that we don't hear about the victims of American fought wars, of course. I mean, that's a perennial, and we're hearing that in Afghanistan. But we're also not hearing a lot, and we certainly didn't this year, about what happens to countries that we bomb and shoot up after we leave. And so, for example, we haven't actually left Iraq yet. We still have plenty of troops there. We're just not calling them combat troops. But Iraqi democracy is very much in shambles, and it's very much not looking like a democracy these days, as al-Maliki, the guy we set up in charge there, has increasingly taken on the trappings of a non-democratic state. But what's been happening in Pakistan and Yemen with the drone programs there. And then Libya, briefly in the news again the last couple of days over the detention of U.S. military officials there. But the fact that even 2 years after the United States and NATO airstrikes in Libya, that there is no functional central government in Libya, really, to speak of, that the security situation there is a nightmare, and that this is a direct effect, reflection of what the U.S. has created there.
Yeah, on my list too, two contrasting protests In Egypt, the protests over the coup in Egypt and the U.S. government's support for the Egyptian military in overthrowing a democratically elected government proves that the U.S. government can't help getting rid of democracies they just don't like. At the same time, in Thailand, protests going on there, when they are reported in the Western media, they are reported as protests against a corrupt government, when in fact the Thai government is also democratically elected. And the reason the protesters are out in the streets in Bangkok mostly, rather than the rest of the country, is because they don't like a government that has instituted universal health care, particularly for the rural poor, and also is trying to do something for folks who don't live in Bangkok. The protesters in the streets of Bangkok are so anti-democratic that they want to return the country to an absolute monarchy and dissolve an elected legislature. That's something that's not being reported in the U.S. press at all.
Yeah. Speaking countries across the Pacific, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has gotten very little attention this year. This basically is the new free trade agreement that the United States is hammering out with a whole bunch of different countries. We're back to the era of multilateral agreements again. That approach was dropped for a number of years after the WTO protests in Seattle 15 years ago, believe it or not, 1999. And the blowback against that by non-aligned and underdeveloped countries. We're back with that again with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, with a lot of the same aspects as, say, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments and some of the other proposals that were up for consideration 15 years ago that would deregulate international finance, that would cement U.S. copyright law and patent law in a way that's very discriminatory against third world countries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Very, very dangerous document that is opposed in a lot of the world, has gotten almost no attention in the United States. Also, across the Pacific, Fukushima keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, and the accountability for it, both by TEPCO and the Japanese government, has been a huge issue in Japan and internationally, but not so much in the U.S. media.
Yes, that was also on my list, that in September, the Japanese government finally took over the cleanup of Fukushima from TEPCO, the company that owns the nuclear disaster, which used to be a nuclear plant. They found a huge mess when they took over the cleanup. They found tanks. They found actually a facility that was crowded with water tanks with very little room left to add more water tanks. Those tanks were held together with rubber seams and seals that are decaying rapidly and spilling radioactive water into the water table and into the Pacific Ocean. Literally, it is the disaster that will never go away.
Yeah, and just it's a nuclear plant that I used to know.
Yes, that's nuclear power for you.
Yeah, and lastly, in Guatemala, Efren Rios Montt sentenced to 80 months in prison, the former dictator there, for convicted of crimes against humanity by a court in his own country. It's a very light sentence, even though he's an elderly guy. But this is somebody who was running for president just a few years ago. And the precedent that sets internationally of people being held accountable by justice systems in their own country for crimes against humanity. Just imagine a U.S. court sentencing George W. Bush to prison, and you'll get an idea of how much farther ahead in terms of democratic accountability much of the rest of the world is compared to what we do in the United States.
All right.
Oh, and there was an excellent example of underreported and what the kind of mentality that leads to this past week in the Washington Post, where there was a big Sunday investigative piece by Dana Priest, who's a justifiably well-known investigative reporter there, won Pulitzers, et cetera. It was a report on CIA support for the Colombian government's war on the FARC rebels in Colombia, a civil war that's been going on for 50 years or so. And starting with George Bush in 2000, the United States putting an enormous number of resources into helping to suppress that, even though the Colombian government has a terrible human rights record, blah, blah, blah. Now, this is news only to somebody who has been relying on U.S. media or who has not been particularly paying attention for the last 15 years. The Colombian government's terrible human rights record, the U.S. support of it anyway, because it's the only government left in South America that is willing to host large U.S. military bases and buy huge amounts of U.S. armaments so that it can be used again in the war against FARC. I mean, this is all stuff that should be reported regularly in the U.S. media, but the fact that it has to be an investigative report and is treated as this big sensational news find that nobody knew about before just really shows how bad international reporting is in the United States and how one-sided it is.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jog Parrish, Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And later this weekend, we will have up all of the underreported and overhyped stories of 2013 that we've been going on and on about for the last 3 weeks. And we'll be doing a lot more of this in 2014. So Happy New Year to everyone.
Right. Happy New Year.